Welcome home. We are WNSG, AM 1570, Tassel, Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive Positively at Zeke's Coffee. We're here in Lauraville, the whole of Sickville, is like I like to call it. We are fueled by Zeke's Coffee here today for sure. I told him decaf. That better be decaf in this cup here. I don't know what they did to me.
Might have.
Does not seem like they gave it to
me. I think Roderick thinks they damped me or something. Pressure luck as well as lucky seven doubles. I'll have these in August. Our 27th anniversary happens on August 3rd. Beginning on August 4th, I'm going to my 27 favorite places to eat and things to eat around the city. Some of them are a little bougie, like a fried lobster tail at Beaumont on the 7th of August. And some of them are going to be very humble, like an egg custard snowball or some cookies up the street. Might even be peach cake involved in this before it's all over with. Rasig has decided to stick around. Kevin Colliger, Cal, political cartoonist, deposed. I just like saying that because it sounds like it sounds like an overthrow from a government. And we
was an overthrow by the government.
It is.
Indirectly.
Rasig, I'm going to have you introduce your offspring, who is an unwilling contestant on the program. Your other kid's been on. Your other kid.
Tup has been on.
So, I have pictures of Tup on the set.
Okay.
Up at the barn. Maybe you were in it, too. It was one of the anniversaries where you did an anniversary thing. It's probably my fifth anniversary. Probably 1997.
Okay.
All right? And I know your brother's in it because he's the one who officially named me Nasty Nestor, I think. But you were a part of it, and it can be blamed on both of you. I only blame it on your brother if you want to take any acknowledgement of the story, because Cal is like, Nasty Nestor, well, I didn't know this, and I only know he was Nasty Nestor. And I haven't met Cal until 20 minutes ago, and we just had our first biscuit together. Rasig, I have known since 1984. February of 1984, I began in January. I say February generously because Rasig was one of the first people I met at Sports First. And the newspaper fell apart in September, but we sort of hung around with the News American for another minute and a half. And then I went to the Sun on January 6, 1986. During that period of time, I was trying to be taken seriously as a journalist and keep my gig with Jack Gibbons. We brought that up in the last segment. And there was a summer night, and I've looked up the date. It was in the late 1980s, 88 or 89. It was 89, I think. Eddie Murray had gone off to the Los Angeles Dodgers. He had played up in Veterans Stadium on a Sunday afternoon, hit like three home runs. You can look this up. Had like eight RBIs. And in that, I went to that game, and I came home the pissed off Oriole fan that we've all been since 1983. This is early on, and we still thought we could win. And I came back, and I said to Rasig, who was a big rotisserie baseball player.
Yes,
I said to Rasig, I saw Eddie Murray hit home runs off of guys I've never heard of. And I said, these bums that the Phillies brought in, I've never heard of these guys. I said, and he's like, I probably heard of them. I play rotisserie. And I'm like, if you know who these guys are, I'll babysit your kids.
Oh, yeah, this is how it went, Cal.
So this is how it went. How old were you in the summer, 88 or 8? I'm going to look up the date on that.
I'll date myself. Six, I think I was six or seven.
You were the older brother.
Yeah, that's right. Still am.
Somehow he has maintained that.
One of my proudest accomplishments
as a brother.
I'm going
to get the right date on this because I did. There's a whole clip thing I've done. So people ask me all the time, why Nasty Nestor? What did your friends call? First off, my childhood nickname was Jody, which I hated.
Jody.
See that? Yeah. That now you know why I hated it, right? So right, exactly. So I was missing
Jody
a finger
Aparicio.
When I was little. So it was all sorts of things where I could fake pick my nose, wear four fingered nest. Then the Christmas donkey happened. Nestor, the long eared Christmas donkey, right? You remember this? So Nestor is such a weird name, only made great by Nestor Shylock. Nestor Torres is the greatest flautist in the world, was jazz flautist. I met him on an airplane one time. He told me I was the only Nestor he had ever met.
Right.
Such an awkwardly bizarre name. It's my father's name as well. There was a Nestor who ran Argentina. I think of his last name.
And
Nestor Kirchner.
Jimmy Smith played a character named Nestor.
Nestor on a television show.
Exactly.
Right. And then there is the baseball pitcher who salvaged me and made your nickname famous, you or your brother, I don't know which one it was, or both of you, that Nasty Nestor Cortez would be the pitcher.
Cortez, right.
So on this particular night, I remember being on the fifth floor, and I made this challenge to Rasig, and the answer to the pitcher was Todd Froworth, who later became a friend of mine, the late, great Todd Froworth, who became a friend of mine later as an Oriole, but he won the babysitting night with Todd. And I had a, my son was born in 84. You 81?
82.
82, and your brother was?
83.
Yeah. And my kids, so you are 1 year apart. I felt bigger than that when you were kids. So I had a five-year-old kid. He's a six-year-old kid. Had a four-year-old brother, and I'm taking on these three young gentlemen to babysit.
Oh, I forgot you had, because your son was a part of this.
I lost a bet.
Yeah.
Right. So I lost the bet.
Speaks a lot to your fathering skills that he's the babysitter.
So exactly, they decided probably to go out with Nick the Greek or something and have dinner. Probably went up to Peppers or something, went dancing.
Oh, Peppers.
You know, I don't know. You probably, you know, you're going somewhere. It's 1989, right?
Yeah.
So I came over to the house that night, and Terry, who was in Africa, we're going to give some love to in a minute, had all this barbecue together, and she says, all you have to do is fire up the grill and do the barbecue. And we left the chicken on the grill. Do you want to pick the story up? Do you not remember any part of this?
Very little recollection, but now that you say the chicken, I do. You botched the chicken, you burned the chicken.
And I sent you to bed.
Oh.
I had to get you in the tub. I mean, it was a whole thing. I mean, you
kids. You gave them baths?
No, they had to get in the shower. Dude, they were filthy. No, I mean, like, it was like, okay, you guys are you're getting cleaned up and you're going to bed. And they were pissed at me. Him and his brother. And instead of Uncle Nestor, and Uncle Buck was like a movie then and all that, they started calling me.
Nasty. You're just so, he's just so nasty, or you're just so nasty, I remember someone saying. So, he's just so nasty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did Terry give me that name?
No.
Did these kids even know what nasty was when they were six?
I think.
These are smart kids. These are accomplished kids you've had here.
So nasty.
Yeah. You are. So nasty is good. All right.
Well, when people ask me how I became Nasty Nestor, this kid who's now 40, how are you and how is your brother? The two people ask me about the Nasty Nestor thing, and I say it's for six kids, and I always, you'll always be 6 and 4 to me, right?
Right.
Or 8 and 6, more like that.
And
you know,
still,
like,
however old you were when you were babysitting us, I still, even though I'm probably 20 years older than that now.
I'm still 23 to you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I love that. Yeah, you know, I want to be 23 to you the rest of my life.
You know who else loved my boys was John Steadman. He loved Stephen Tupp. He really did. He was fascinated with my children.
Well, they were such smart, well-behaved. I mean, and they
well-behaved?
Listen. Okay. They channel your wife more than you. You would admit,
yes.
Mannerism wise, the way they look, the way you draw them,
they're good looking. Unlike their dad,
They have a perma smile about them. They both smile a lot, and they can't help it. What do you say, resting bitch face? Is it like an internet thing, right? You have resting smile face, all of you. The way your eyes are, you always
that.
Look.
That's just the way I draw.
Happy.
Right, exactly. You draw us as an Asian family. No,
you look like a happy Finnish Inuit family at the North Pole waiting for Santa to come down on every Christmas card.
That's right. That's right.
Cal is just laughing.
That
because,
is
like,
a great meta. I mean, where did you come up with that visual? It's fantastic.
Because I've seen 41 Christmas cards of his family every year. I mean, he's drawn a dozen for me.
Well, but these guys is
Nick
Inuit.
And Nick the Greeks and every one of them.
Right.
You know?
So speaking of Cal, I'll sidestep talking about myself, but I will tell a quick story about Cal, and or really it's still about me, but I was at the climbing gym in Baltimore, and a friend introduced me to she was like, you're gonna love this girl Amy, she's so cool, she's so fun, you guys are gonna be best friends, you got to meet this girl. So
when is this, how long ago is
this? Is about 6 years ago.
As an adult.
And I, sure enough, she was a delight. And I remember we walked around, like, the Hopkins campus. There was some crazy event going down in that Wyman Park Dell area.
Oh, yeah.
Just some nutso event. And she was super, super fun, like, wild tattoos. Anyway.
Wild. She's wild, too, yeah.
We started talking, and what does your dad do, that type of thing. And I'm like, my dad's a cartoonist. She was like, cartoonist? She's like, my dad's a cartoonist. Like, there's can't be that many of those. she was like, yeah, like, have you ever heard of Cal? And I was like, Cal, of course, Cal. She's like, I'm Amy Callagher. Cal's my father. And so we...
No wonder you're cool.
No wonder you're cool. Exactly. Kids of cartoonists. So we did, in fact, become great friends. And, you know, it's
We broke bread together, the four of us, at Cal's house.
There's nothing better when somebody
crabs,
tells me they
really
love my kid.
We broke crabs,
you know what I mean?
Together. Yeah.
When somebody comes up and says, I love your kid, and I'm like, man, my kid's great. Everybody loves my kid. Yeah. You know, me, I'm an acquired taste, as you're finding out, Cal.
Right,
you know?
Right. Good but, taste, though. So far, it's good.
You're
it's
not shocked to find out that your daughter's lovely, right?
No, that's quite nice. Today's her birthday, too.
Oh, man. Happy birthday, Amy.
This was all planned in advance.
I know where you can get some cake right here. We're at Zeke's Coffee. Steve is here. Tup's on it. What's Tup doing? Did you name me Nasty Nestor, or did he, or did your mom, like, put you up to it?
I'll say I did.
I haven't spoken to you in 20 years. I want to know.
I'll say it was me so we can have this confrontation.
My friend Doc claims it's him that named it.
Oh, really?
Yes. That's a different story. So, you know.
Who named Nasty Nestor Cortez? I've never met that guy, but I'm thinking at this point, maybe this involves your other kid. I was in New York a couple weeks ago, and I thought, I'm going to go up to, like, Yankee Stadium and go into those shops, stands, and all that, and try to find some discounted Nasty Nestor gear.
Oh, right,
because I feel like he's gone now, right? And they did all those cartoons of him. I mean, he was, like, the mustache, the whole deal.
Right,
that'd
be a funny
He was a great
shirt.
Guy to cartoon, right?
That'd be a fun shirt.
Yeah, so there's 100 of them. I get them on the internet, but I'm like, I want to go up and, like, sort of finger through, maybe find something I can't find on the internet, but Nasty Nestor, you know, all these years later, and then my name got usurped by this guy who was a bum with the Orioles, who goes on and makes an All-Star game with
yes,
the Yankees, you know?
Exactly.
But I love being Nasty Nestor at this point. I introduce myself now when I go up to people, they say, what's your name? And I say Ness, like Cal, like Rasig, and they're like, Net. Like, if I'm at the coffee shop, she says, what's your name? Nestor. Huh? Nester. Well, that first off, that's not how it's spelled, and it's weird. And if you say rhymes with Lester or, you know, whatever. But if I said my name was Wes, like Wes Unseld or, you know, Wes Moore, right, you'd say, oh, Wes. I'm like, Ness rhymes with Wes. Oh, okay, right? So that Nasty Nestor, nobody ever called me Ness when I was a kid. Everybody almost calls me Ness now because it's it's what people started calling me.
Right.
But the Nasty thing, there's not a day of my life.
Call you Ness.
There's not a day of my life where I don't walk the street. I mean, I've already been called Nasty at that table two or three times. I mean, it's what anybody that listen calls me. It sort of delineates between a fan and a friend to some degree. You know, I mean, anybody's a listener will call me Nasty. Anybody that knows me will call me Ness. Anybody that doesn't know me will say, what do you want to be called, right? But the Nasty thing has opened doors and it has shut doors.
Sure.
Of course, time.
You're welcome, either way.
Well, the real story is I went on the radio in 91 and my boss said, it was such a weird thing to say, I'm Nestor. No, you have to reset. And it just sort of, you were calling me that, and my, I had a wallet that said Nasty on it that may have gotten gifted to me by somebody, and it didn't even have anything to do with the alliterative part. It just said Nasty on it. Somebody gave me the wallet, and Jim Ward was my boss, and he said, you go on here, call yourself Nasty, you better damn well be Nasty. He was a Philadelphia sports guy, you know what I mean? And
he wanted you to be
Nasty. He wanted me
Nasty.
To throw punches, like that. And I'm like, nah, you know, it's more like the Janet Jackson song. Nasty, Nasty Boy. It just gave me, it was like a little bit of a, Nasty was like,
Like the Nasty Boys for the Pistons.
The
Pistons, weren't
they?
Oh, they
were the Bad Boys.
Oh, they were the Bad Boys.
The Nasty Boys was Rob Dibble.
Yes, that's right.
Cincinnati Reds guys,
Dibble,
right?
And yeah.
So there was a part of it that was like sort of a street term that was sort of like, oh, he's nasty, he's fresh, he's cool. You know, it wasn't like being a bad human,
right? Which is how I intended it at the time when I was a kid.
Yes, exactly.
Because that made you take a bath and go to bed.
That's right.
Yes,
that's right.
Exactly.
I think I ordered him pizza. They did not go to bed starved. We burned the chicken. It was a long story. So I took it on the air, and then people come up to me every day with some weird story, but this is the wildest one. Last Saturday, I'm at Costas, and Paul Manna, who does the Trifecta Food Festival and the concerts and all that stuff, he's a big concert promoter. He says his wife said to me, my mother had a picture of you on her refrigerator. And it was the Nasty in my glasses that was like a shot that Baltimore Magazine had done. I said, how did that happen? She was a big band listener in 1992, 93, 94. And
band?
Big band at WITH, where
okay.
I got my start.
Right.
And I was on Screaming Nasty Nester
oh,
stuff.
Oh, okay.
And the Nasty theme song. Do you remember the Nasty theme song? The
no.
Kwame? Do you want
to oh, right, yes.
Kwame is the artist, is going into the Hip Hop Hall of Fame this month, and I think I'm getting them on the show. And he's
nice.
The artist of the Nasty theme song, N-A-S-T-E-E, and he played in Druid Hill Park last week.
Wow, that's
he
very
did a Baltimore
cool.
thing. He's a Philadelphia rapper.
Now I can't
so
get
I'm giving
your,
you the whole Nasty
theme song out of my head.
That
you know?
Theme song was very good.
But people always ask me about the genesis of that. Why did you call yourself Nasty Nester? I'm like, I didn't call me that.
Right.
You called
like
me
any
that.
True good nickname. You can't give it to yourself. You have to earn
exactly.
it.
Ah, exactly.
That's right.
And then
point, right.
it just took off. So there we have it. How did Cal become Cal?
Well, so my last name is Callaher. But what happened was when I was in high school, I went to a high school in Connecticut. That's where I grew up. And my brother's 3 years older. He's a senior. I come in as a freshman. And my brother's name was Cal. Everybody called him Cal. You know, short for Callaher. And but when I came in as a freshman, I was little Cal. So for the first 3 years, I was Little Cal.
Little Cal.
Little Cal. But when he left, I became Cal. And then it was a lot more fun when I started doing cartoons, which I did do in high school. Then I could sign them Cal. And that was, you know, in those days, that's what
were they editorial cartoons in high school, too? Or was it kind of a strip? Or
it was kind of a little bit of both. I mean, because it was commentary about your high school. Right?
Yes,
you know,
right.
That kind
yeah.
of stuff right, was going on. But I remember one of the first cartoons I did got me in really big trouble. And kind of prepped me a little bit for the career that I'm in.
Right.
But actually, I'm going to back up even early in the fifth grade. I was at a Catholic school in Norwalk, Connecticut. And we had a music teacher who was a nun, and she would always sing with her eyes closed. And I was sitting in the back of the classroom, and I go, man, I just got to get this down on paper. So I was scribbling this thing. You
You're
know,
a troublemaker.
Maybe. You know.
Wait, this is three troublemakers here,
I mean,
right? I mean, really, right?
So
good trouble. Good trouble.
I also did teacher drawings in class, too, so I take a lot of cartoons.
You know what I did is I did rock logos. Like, I'm wearing my belt buckle today. This is I'm wearing
Ooh.
My ELO belt buckle today.
Oh, yeah.
So I... But I did the Styx logo. The Rush one was really hard, but Styx had, like, straight lines. So I was always
you
trying to,
it?
Like, yeah, on my notebook. I mean, like, Journey
okay,
had the
right,
wings.
Right.
Van Halen had the VH. I think every kid my age, I mean, John Allen, who's an incredible artist, who you went to that concert
yes,
with me.
Right.
I mean, that was 1979, 80, 81. I went to middle school. And it was either the brown paper bag, your dad would get you the, you know, or you'd want an Orioles thing you bought at the mall or something like that. But everyone drew on their blue notebook, and they were mainly rock and roll logos or angels or different sort of, but rock logos, the AC/DC logo, the sort of symmetry of all that. Right. That was sketchy for, if I would have gone to my art class in eighth grade, she would have said, hey, kid, you seem to like drawing a little bit.
Yeah.
I would want to draw a logo, a rock and roll
no, that's
logo.
True.
You know?
That's true.
Now let Cal finish what he was
no,
talking
about.
Yeah. So what happens is I'm doing this sketch of the teacher, right, with a mouth the size of a battleship. And I'm having, it's for me, right? But the girl next to me sees this thing. She picks it up, has a little giggle, passes it to the kid next to her, and the cartoon starts going around the classroom. And, you know, you're 12 years old, and the affirmation from your kids. This is like great. Oh man, you know, this is awesome. Until the teacher gets a hold of the cartoon, the nun. And she takes me by the ear down to the boys' room.
Man.
Makes me take a bite out of a bar of soap.
This is right out of a Christmas story.
Yeah, it really is, Cal.
And he says, don't you ever draw another one like that. And I've been doing them ever since.
Right. Exactly.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess the reason I even brought up is we've all scribbled in school, right? Whether it was notes or this or but to have the aptitude to be a cartoonist, I mean, it's an audacious thought, right?
Yes.
At that point,
yes.
To think that your art was going to be in a newspaper or that you would be a line of work.
It is.
It's like being a radio disc person. Like, it didn't feel like a job to me that you went when you went to school, right?
Yeah.
So were you like a Mad Magazine guy too?
Yeah, I enjoyed Mad Magazine. One of the curious things about all cartoonists is that there's no school for cartooning.
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a few places now, but there's no graduate degree in it or anything. No. But what happened was is that we all learned by looking at other cartoons, other cartoonists,
sure.
getting books, reading through them. And going to your phrase, which I thought was really interesting, is audacious to have a thought that you could become a cartoonist.
Yes.
And for me, one of the things that really helped me in that path was I was about 14. There was an article in the New York Times said there was a new museum of cartoons opening up in Greenwich, Connecticut. It's about 20-minute ride from the house. I showed this to my mom, said, hey, we got to go check this place out. So we drive, we get the
You were obsessed
address.
With cartooning?
Oh, yeah, I've been drawing and you know.
But how do you even intake it? Cartoons were much more common then, strips and stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yes. Strips, not necessarily political stuff.
That's right.
I see. I think of you as sports and you as political.
Yeah, yeah.
Both of you came from Blondie and Dagwood,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah.
and, sure, like of, all
yeah.
of that.
That's exactly
I wasn't
right.
the kid that read the comic thing. I was the kid that read the sports, right?
That's
You
it.
Were the ones, yeah. when you got the newspaper, the comics were
yes.
the most important part of the... Okay,
okay.
I'm learning about that.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
thinking,
true.
Because it's, you know, people don't have that experience anymore.
That's right.
They
that's
really
absolutely
don't.
Right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. So you go find this place, this location, and it's a house. It's like in a neighborhood. There's like no other commercial places nearby. It looks empty, and we're wondering, have we got this right? We drive up the driveway. We're kind of looking around. It's all black, and then a car pulls up, and it's this guy who's a cartoonist, and he's getting out, and he's got some boxes, and
nice.
You know, and he's going to be loading stuff inside the house, and then he tells us the story. And the story was, at that time, we're talking in the 60s,
By the way, your kid just dropped the mic and rolled. Bye, I love you. See
good
you. Bye,
you.
Good. Be good. All right, there you go.
That there was a law that passed, partly because of Watergate and what Nixon tried to do. He built his presidential library, as they do, and he wanted to donate, say, letters that people had written to him and other things, and deduct thousands of dollars for each one of these things. And Congress kind of always says, no. Instead, now, if you want to donate a cartoon to charity or something, you can only claim the cost of the paper and the ink.
Oh.
Okay? But the problem is that if you passed away, your estate would be taxed at the full market value of the cartoon.
Oh, that seems very unfair.
So I've done 11,000 published cartoons.
11,000? Wow. I thought I had a lot, Cal. That is a lot.
You multiply that, let's just pick a number, by 200 or 400 per
right.
cartoon,
sure.
and suddenly money gets serious. In those days, the estate tax was low threshold. So cartoonists were going to be, if they died, they were going to leave their family with this huge tax bill. So guys were burning their cartoons. They were throwing them away. They didn't want to have them around.
Oh,
and so the cartoonists got together and said, no, we'll let's get a museum.
Can't have Charles Schulz doing that, right? No?
Yes. And so we'll try to figure something out. And so they were bringing in boxes of cartoons. And so I volunteered to go there. My mom would drive me there every month or every few weeks. And I was holding cartoons. I was looking at cartoons. I was meeting cartoonists. So suddenly it didn't seem as so.
What year is this?
Late 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, that kind of, right around 1970, right
okay.
around there. No, mid to late 60s. And so, having met cartoons, it suddenly became something approachable. And that was, a great blessing for me. So then I went to high school, did cartoons for my high school paper, did comic strip.
Sure.
I also got in trouble again. My first year there, I got another serious trouble, like this teacher thing that I had in grammar school. The newspaper, the editor was a friend of my brother's. He was a senior. I was a freshman. He knew I'd draw. He said, hey, come and draw some cartoons for us. I said, great. We're doing this story comparing our school to a pond for frogs. So everybody starts off as tadpoles, and then over 4 years, they become a big frog. And so I was drawing all these different things. But at the end, on the back page, I decided, and they thought it was okay, that I'd do a cartoon of the Dean of Men, who was like the head enforcer, who was a priest by the name of Father Devi.
You're about to kick it power.
And he
kicking
was
power.
And I drew him as the Dean of Frogs.
Oh,
and
boy.
He looked like a frog. And I, in a big jutting out teeth,
and, you know, big overlapping lip.
He did not like your portrayal of his image.
Not only he didn't like it, they had, like, faculty meetings to decide whether they should shut down the paper. I mean, it was just like, you know, freedom of expression. Shall we let the kids do this? This is an insult. It'll undermine authority. Blah, blah, blah. All of this stuff. And I'm like a freshman. I'm thinking, fuck, they're going to throw me out of school.
Yes, right.
Right?
Yes.
So that
the first of many times you were intimidated, right?
So I have one I can throw in here, too. So This is now working for the Courier Express in Buffalo, my first newspaper job. And I had a friend who went to Canisius College, and their arch rival was St. Bonaventure College. Mm. And they had a phrase there that was Buck Fauna, which was flip it. You know, it's F Bona. Oh. You know, that was their
word. Yeah.
And so it was a word that was out there. And
late 70s here.
This is late 70s,
okay, all right. And era is important for all of this, right?
Right.
It's the context
and
of all
so
of it.
I slipped this word, Buck Fauna.
Buck Fauna.
Which is like a nonsense word, but it had meaning to Canisius fans and to a lot of fans. I slipped it into a cartoon one time and got away with it, except for that the editor found out about what it meant. Somebody called up and said, hey, we know what that means, and it's, you know, not for a newspaper. And so the editor calls me in and says, you will never use that word again in our newspaper or you will be fired. And I was like, I'm a bachelor at this point. I'm not a married person with kids. So my whole thing is cartoon thing. You know, like, I got to get away with this. So I found 35 different ways to slip Buck Fauna into the newspaper going forward until that paper folded.
That including, is fantastic.
Including, like, here's one that I did. I had an art, like it was like an Artscape type of drawing that they asked me to do. And I had all the different art booths numbered. And there was, if you connected the dots in it with a big red marker, it spelled Buck Fauna across the entire newspaper. And and nobody caught it except for one sports guy who said it. And I said, dude, you got to be quiet about that. Yeah. Like, don't say anything. Right, but on the last day of the paper, they had a party. And
this is twisted, right? You're doing something that only you can know about.
But Cal knows this. Like, he knows he's the same as me.
I know.
We like slipping stuff in. Yeah. And so
I do it all the time in modern words.
Course.
And they either mean something to somebody or they don't.
So on that last day at the party, I was asked to be a speaker. And I brought out all the different ways I had slipped Buck Fauna. I had every newspaper. I had. I was on TV one day, and they did a promo photo of me, and I slipped Buck Fauna into the background of the photo. I found all kinds of ways to slip it in, but I revealed them all at that party. You know, so it was
bravo.
Oh man,
that
must have been a big night when the reveal party.
Oh, it was really funny, and my editor was very mad at me for because I defied him basically, but it didn't matter. The paper folded.
But hold on, man, I defied him. Let's go back to this. Kevin Colliger's here, and Rasig's here. We're at Zeke's Coffee.
Here's some Cal art right here,
that's
everyone.
Beer,
Cal does.
I know Steve Demjuk. I know all about Poe.
This is
the best. Raven beer, and this is.
Yeah, Cal's.
It's delicious.
It's
and
delicious,
made locally, just like the coffee here at Zeke's Coffee. I didn't even meet you off the air. I met you here. And one of the first things you said to me, and literally, if I go back about an hour ago, was first thing you learn here is you're going to piss somebody off, you know?
Yeah.
And then what you do with that once you piss somebody off.
Yeah.
I never thought, like, in my show, in my line of work, that it would be that I would get nearly the kind of hate. And it speaks to what Dan talked about a little bit, too, being modern, right? Used to be phone calls. You could call and debate with me. I can't imagine a world taking phone calls right now because, to some degree, you make it for the audience. And I know Dan sort of bristled when I said you're not writing for the audience. You really aren't. You're writing what you think needs to be said.
Yes.
And not worrying about who reads it. They're reading your truth. And I even put up a thing the other day about my truth, and somebody wants to argue your truth, the truth. No, that. My truth is what my cartoon is, what my words are, what we say, and then the implicit meaning behind it and the thought put behind being creative and not just spouting out on the radio in real time like I do. You guys go into a think tank with yourself, and like any writer would before you write something. Mine's much more sort of immediate in this way. But when you start to put that together and start to think through panels, or is it one piece? How mean do I want to be? Is that racist, sexist, unfair? You know, whatever. Is that off the top rope? Is that is that going to cost me my job? Like,
or at least cost you the chance to get your message into the paper that day, because you want to, you will still want to get your message across. And if you know it's going to get shot down because of one little thing that you put in there that's distasteful or whatever, that, or that the editor is going to object to. So you're your own editor is what it is.
Yeah, I think the key term that I use is whether you can have an effective cartoon. So what does it, what does that mean, effective? It means that you want to get your point across. That's the number one priority. And the second thing is you want to engage people. But if you engage people with either metaphor that you know is going to be a charged metaphor that's going to get people going, or the imagery. And Cartoon, for a while, I was president of an international human rights group for cartoonists who around the world get arrested, jailed, worse, for what they do.
Chris Van Hollen came on last year at Mako and sat with me and said, journalist, most dangerous job in the world.
Yeah.
Now it is.
Most dangerous job in the world, journalist.
Now.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, cartoonist doesn't sound nearly as imposing as journalist. Cartoonists are the most powerful journalists in a lot of places,
right,
where people can't read, but they can interpret.
Right.
You know, literally the first thing we ever learned to do was draw stick figures, right?
That's right. Like, that's right.
That's a different language that you speak in, right?
Absolutely. And plus, the caricature is a real key component to that, because any person who's powerful understands this. If there's a person who can take their face apart, their most valuable prized possession, and then reassemble it under their control, and then be them having power and wanting to control everything around, that is a dangerous person. And so they will go for those people first.
Yes.
And try to silence them. In fact, you can. I can judge the freedom of any country first by determining if the cartoonist can draw their own head of state. And I remember having a conversation with a bunch of
That might be the most astute thing I've heard on this show this year. I mean, say that again. Now I got to stop. And,
right.
That you judge a country and a culture based on whether a cartoonist can draw its leader.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's bottom line.
Let me ask you this then, because a lot of times, like say you get a new president.
Yeah.
And he's Joe Biden, you know, who is, I don't know, you have to solve him as a cartoonist, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's, you know.
What do you mean by that? Define solve.
Because some people, like Lyndon Johnson, say, are much, much easier to draw or caricature than someone that's, you know, a normal-looking face. You know, I guess it would be. So especially someone like Cal, I'm actually asking him this because he is really much more of a caricaturist than I am. So, you know, how do you go about that? How do you do that?
Well, first of all, I love the face. You know, I've been drawing characters my whole life. It's one of the greatest challenges. I mean, we know we're all interested in people. We're curious. I mean, one of the fun places for me to be is in the front, like of Zeke's here, where you're watching people go by in the street.
You're like a real artist.
You know,
like a Parisian.
Yeah. It's fun. I think all of us do it anyways. Like somebody walks in.
We take pictures in our mind.
And they suss them out, and they can make some sort of judgment, or an assessment rather than a judgment. Some people make judgments, I guess. But an assessment of that character, who it is, and so on. When I was playing basketball, I used to play pickup basketball until I was in my mid to late 50s. And one of the great things is showing up at a playground or showing up at a gym, and you have to get a fix on people, not by the way they shoot, by what they're wearing, the way they walk. Because when you choose a team, you want to get on a team, you want to win and stay on the court.
Yes.
So you're only going to pick the four or five guys that you want to have on your team. And so you judge that person. Nah, I'm not so sure about that one. Okay. And then you might see if they shoot, whether they got it and so on. So, again, it's very simple judgments and assessments. So faces, of course, are the most potent thing for expression for any individual. And so I always, the eyes are really
judge
tremendous.
Judge man by his eyes, I was going to say. Yeah,
eyes are cool. But it's, you know what it is? You know what the most important part is? The shape of your head. And it's the reason why from a distance we can recognize somebody, or from behind, is because the shape of the head. So you start there, get that shape right.
Sig's nodding his head like, yeah, man, it's like fun talking to a cartoonist. Yeah.
I can remember faces and I can never remember names, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. And I'm the exact same. So then you go inside that structure of the face that you've established and trying to find the inner shapes that are distinct to that individual, where the cheekbones are, you know. The eyes are shapes, but some eyes are big, some eyes are small. Where do they go? How close together? How far apart? You know, ears, they're a shape. They affect the overall shape. The ears go big. Do they go small? Do they make them not even there? Donald Trump doesn't have any ears from what I can see because you never see him. You don't even think about his ears.
I saw one get shot off. Legendary.
Yes.
And then, but Barack Obama, the ears, of course, are central to his shape of his head.
Exactly.
So, but then here's the magic bit. And this is, there's a degree of mystery, even for me, but I've been doing this for such a long time, is trying to capture the essence of that person within those shapes. One of my favorite quotes about caricature comes from this Italian Renaissance painter, Annabelle Carracci, who said, "A good caricature is more true to life than reality itself." So you're trying to capture something that is bigger and unique. The reason why, if we had a statue here of Rusig, it wouldn't look alive. But when you look at Rusig, he's alive because there's all this subtle stuff that's giving you these messages. So when I try to do a caricature, my goal, aspiration, I don't always achieve it. My aspiration is to try to get something that exudes that character. Even if it's in cartoon form, maybe it's exaggerated, all that sort of stuff. It's trying to get to that inner bit that makes them special. For a long time, I did caricatures on the streets. We've all seen those guys.
Yeah.
My mother had one of me done at the harbor when I was a boy. Yeah. I still have.
It's not easy work.
It's not.
Yeah.
It is not easy
work. It's magical anytime you're anywhere watching artists do that work. Yeah. Even for artists, do you think it's magical?
It is. I mean,
and you do the work.
I love watching people draw. There was this one situation when I was in the UK where three cartoonists got together, you know, afternoon barbecue, hanging out, you know, beautiful weather. The pens come out, the papers come out, right? And what we did is we sat in a triangle close enough so we could see each other. And one on my left drew me.
Yes.
I drew the one on my right. And so this triangle where everybody was drawing each other. And then after we did one drawing, we switched directions. But the thing was that was most fun for me was watching how they drew it because they drew differently to me.
Yes.
And when you see a page, a pen or a pencil drag across a paper, there's no special effects there. It is pure
magic. I've watched
him
for hours years ago.
Yes.
Because he and I have been that close. Yeah. He's done stuff with me. And I've sat at his house after football games when he was creating cartoons back in the 80s, especially after, what's his name, missed the kick? Norwood, right? I mean, that was...
Oh.
I got a cartoon you did of me with the Oilers and the Bills, but his were always sporty and I understood stuff. The political stuff is much more, I think, broad to some degree, you know what I mean? Trying to get a point across or make a point for somebody or maybe change their mind. You know what I mean? Mm. I saw your work as a little bit more send up. You weren't trying to make decisions as much. You're trying to, like, the stuff that got you deposed a couple weeks ago at the Baltimore Sun, by the way, the former Baltimore Sun, was crossing a line, right? I mean, you know, in where they were, and also making a point that's so strong that it felt like the banner above it, not the Baltimore banner, but the masthead and the people there didn't want that message to be their message, right? And that's a strong...
It only crosses the line for management at the time, right? I mean, your cartoons haven't crossed
the line. Well, Buck Fano was no good for you, and it would make it onto my FCC airwaves.
That's not... That's just me being a child.
Well, I think that
work, you know, where he's putting it out there and getting his message out, and most people, or most normal thinking people would not find it over the, you know.
Well, I think it's one thing to shut you down because you're Kim Jong-un in North Korea. It's a different thing for your publisher to want to shut you down in Buffalo because it was going to cost them subscribers or have phone calls. It's going to make my phone ring. Legal's going to call.
Yeah,
right?
So whatever those
challenges are, and I've had those challenges about what goes out on these airwaves, about like what I'm willing to have your back on and what I'm not willing to have your back on.
Right.
And I've been sued and like all of that too, that there is a point where whatever happened to you, maybe we lead to that now because, like, honestly, you've said the mouthful and saying, my work's going to piss people off. You acknowledge that in the beginning. And then if I can't draw a leader of the state and then we get to Colbert, right? I mean, and where we are, and I own an FCC license here.
Right.
Hey, man, we're in a different level of being muted, being censored, not even being censored, being shut down, being intimidated, being purged, being thrown out of the Ravens clubhouse when they have sexual predators in there and not being allowed to ask questions anymore, that the media, as Dan pointed out, has been vilified to the point where, oh, F that cartoonist. He made fun of my president.
Oh,
F
sure.
him. He needs to be fired. He needs to be shown a lesson. After 50 years of doing your work, it's like anybody that would think I should be thrown out of the Ravens or Orioles clubhouse is a complete jackass. And I'll say that here, there, anywhere, because you want accountability. You ask the why, and then you don't want people having real voices to ask questions, to get answers, to verify, to hold accountable, to hold power accountable. And your story is right along the line of Colbert, and I hit you 2 weeks ago, and Roderick wasn't even supposed to be here. Dan was supposed to be with me at DePasquale, so it wasn't even a setup. But I kept calling him deposed. He's like, I quit. I wasn't deposed.
That's true.
You know, I was proudly fired at Sporting News Radio. You know what I mean? But I don't know where you are in your emotions of all of this, and you seem to be taking it in stride, but it's...
Did you have
bullshit.
A warning?
I mean, you know, I'm going to say that out loud, you know? I mean,
did you have an inkling of it, Cal, before it happened, or was, how did that actually work?
So, several years before the paper was bought by our friend, I had done some pretty wicked cartoons about Sinclair.
Of course.
Yeah. And one in particular of David Smith. I mean, a really funny... You know, multi-panel story thing about David, so introducing him to the world. You don't know my name, you don't know my face, but you're about to hear my voice, which is through all these stations around the country where he was forcing all the people to spout out conservative perspectives. So I did this. I mean, it's
that's
one
not
of my
an allegation. That's a fact.
It's a fact. It was one of my favorite cartoons, right? And then, and so the second he bought it, I said, I'm toast. I mean, if I get one more week here. That would be amazing.
It's like
you know?
Me on Twitter when the Nazi bought Twitter. My first word of my description was journalist. I was off of Twitter within 10 days.
Wow!
And if I say that out loud, people think that's outright. I've had businesses say, "What did you do to get thrown off of Twitter?" It said journalist, and that's the first thing that he went. Into purge.
Right. Yeah.
And if there's any doubt 3 years later that cat did that,
right.
He absolutely did that. There were all sorts of journalists at that time. I had no power to fight back. I had no Baltimore Sun in front of me or BAL in front of me.
Yeah.
I inquired to Twitter and they said, we've decided you don't cut the standards of being on Twitter anymore. And they threw me and my 10,000 threw me off.
Yeah.
So I mean, in your case, you made it.
A year and a bit. And, you know, and going into my reflection upon the whole thing, and part of the reason why I feel good where I am with this is that, you know, I came over in 1988. The Baltimore Sun took me and my family from England to come here to Baltimore. I got to introduce to Baltimore, raise my family here in Baltimore. What a wonderful experience it was. And it was a gift that the Baltimore Sun gave to me. Then... Oh, I've had so many great experiences, you know, met all sorts of interesting people. I've done award-winning cartoons. I've, you know, great resume buildup. But I also saw over the course of the past two decades the kind of the shrinking of not only the Baltimore Sun but newspapers around the country.
That there would be an end.
And you had to kind of be prepared for that. Fortunately, the Economist is great, and I feel that I have a safe place there. But also, now that I'm Substack, which is, you know, this ability to have your own basic publishing place.
Yes.
Where people come in. You can see my cartoons. I'm doing original cartoon, finishing cartoon today. It's going to go on. The cartoon that would have been in the Baltimore Sun is going to be on the Cal Draws a Line Substack. And you can see my cartoons.
You shifted your brand.
Yeah. I shifted the brand like you've done so many times, right?
Three, four times.
Yeah. But what I love about Substack is that the creator owns the copyright. They own everything. They have the list of people that subscribe. It's not some social media company that's going to take it and then affect the algorithm, who gets to see this and all that sort of stuff. And so I suspect if we're looking as things go forward on the nature of information, where there's going to be so much unreliable information, so much so that the more the AI gets out there, when you can't believe anything that you read on the internet, the thing about something like it's like Substack is that these are real people producing real content, and people gravitate in that direction.
Dan is on it too, right? Dan also.
Yeah.
And I'm blown away at just where the country's gone. I mean, I'm as a Hispanic who thought he was white when he was a kid, you know, I'm blown away by all of it and the purge of media and where all of that's going. But the possibilities for moving a voice and what will be trusted. I said back in 18 and 19, one of the reasons I built Baltimore Positive at heart was I was going to run for mayor. That's first thing. Everybody knows that. Right. But what I thought at that point when I decided to do Baltimore Positive in the summer 2020, Trump's still president, we're all wearing masks, is at some point, people are going to have to come back to something they trust and something that's not bought off and somebody that's not going to bullshit them, right. Somebody that's not going to kowtow to... You can't say that about David Rubenstein because they're in last place, or you can't speak my truth, right? That I still think at the end of all of this, I still believe, like Dan spoke about these ICE agents and, you know, moral responsibility for their actions, and the more we move toward this sort of weirdly Nazi thing that's going on around here at this point, including Colbert, including you, including the people that own the Sun, that the Sun becomes a shell and people are going to look for another place for trust.
Yes.
I mean, I saw the banner. I got served an ad from the banner yesterday by some dude that looks like he's in, you know, getting money, literally begging for donations. So that we're the day after NPR got cut, right? Public television, public radio gets cut, all of that. And we have the banner, which is like the next thing that's going to hopefully keep truth alive or right. Investigative journalism alive as we've known it for the last couple of centuries here. And they're begging for donations. In addition to give me $20 a month to be a subscriber, it's now public television. And I don't know who funds truth, right, in a world where, you know, Colbert can't have a show. Right, and CBS feels like they're so intimidated that they can't underwrite 60 minutes anymore. Shit's slipping pretty quick here over the last six
exactly
months.
I mean,
six months
in a big way. And
exactly,
I still think when this is over with, if the halls of justice are going to win out, they're going to have to trust news and people and information,
right.
And people are going to be looking. 5 years after Trump the first time, I would have said the reason I created Baltimore Positive is I thought people would want to trust people on the streets and the business owners and the people that make up this community and even the politicians that Johnny O, who will come and sit with me and try to give me his truth and then back it up and be accountable to come back 6 months later and answer more questions. That's the world I knew.
Yeah.
I knew that in press conferences. I didn't know we'd have a head coach running down and making nice with Donald Trump 2 weeks ago and hiding about it, right? Like, and now if you bring that out, Chad Steele's going to call you and threaten your press pass.
Right.
Because you're, that has nothing to do with football. What?
Yeah, right.
Like, what? I mean, I've just seen it all slide. And
truth
part, when you talk about you're trusted and your cartoons are trusted by your audience, I think that's all of us. That is our, that's our money right now. That's
right.
That's
absolutely
where it's at. Our
absolutely
trust in our word and our integrity,
yeah,
that's
yep
all we have as artists, as yep creators, and as citizens.
Yep.
I mean, I mean that.
Yeah. Yep. Well, one of the things that, you know, people have asked cartoonists a lot, you know, AI, what does this mean for you and so on. But one of the things about on the web now, there's more satire than ever, which is quite good. There's, you know, that's healthy for democracy to have satire. There's so much of it out there.
Citizen satire.
Yeah,
memes.
Citizen.
That's,
exactly.
It's got a name, memes, right?
So one of the differences between what I do and a meme, and memes, some of them are fantastic, and the capability of AI to create these amazing imagery is amazing. None of them are signed, but the cartoon is signed.
Yes.
So suddenly there's a human there. Maple may either make a connection or at least
I'm responsible for it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I think that creates a different environment and people respond to it differently, being other humans. I mean, that's my take anyway.
Well, I've talked so much about comedy, right? And you both work in, I mean, you're mean, you're nasty, but I chuckle too.
You know, yeah, yeah, sure.
There's a chuckle above and beyond the, oh, that was a punch. And I see this. You make the
why
smile,
is it
right?
Your name, nickname, Nasty Cal.
No, but I mean.
Not too late.
You guys are smiling and chuckling, but you smile at your own work, right?
Yeah, yeah,
of
yeah
course.
I mean, when I write a zinger, when I'm taking down somebody, when I'm writing 8 pages of Pearl Jam lyrics, to get after the lack of integrity Eric DaCosta has shown me over 30 years and what a creep I think he is, I can use Pearl Jam lyrics to get after that. And you guys are smiling. Yeah. Don't think at 3 a.m. when I'm having a cup of coffee and coming off the top rope about still being alive to make my point.
Right.
You know, that I'm smiling as I'm writing zingers. When you're, I mean, you've drawn Putin a million times. You've drawn Trump 1,000 times. You know, you drew Ursay a million times. You drew Angelos a million times.
Yeah, I mean,
is there a point where, like, you're both are smiling at me, but, like, when you're drawing it, you're like, this is going to make people laugh. It's going to make people cry. It's going to piss people off. It's going to inform people.
Oh, yeah,
there's going to be a buck muck in there. There's going to be a Nick the Greek in there. And you're, like, entertaining yourself while
of
you're
course.
Writing the song.
Yeah. I'm sure
know?
Cal's
like,
the same. I'm tickled by... Some stuff that I do,
Oh, yeah. Now, do you find, I mean, I'm sure this happens again, but, you know, we're in this business, when you're dealing with humor, and, you know, you're working with humor, is that you're writing something, you don't exactly know if people are going to, A, get it.
Yes.
Or if it's going to have the intended effect.
Yes.
And so, you're giggling to yourself, and you say, okay, is this, everybody else thinking the same thing? When you take a walk away, and you come back, and you get a fresh view of it, and you go, that's working, or sometimes it's not working. Oh, I need to change those words, or you know, things like that.
Or you miss it entirely, and you put it out there, and no one does get it.
No one gets it. So it is a that is a you know, when you do most when we do cartoons, every cartoon you do is a practice for the next one. You know, all the mistakes
that's
that
a
you
great
made,
statement,
right?
Yeah,
and that you're starting with a blank piece of paper every day, so you get to start anew. But one of the things that happens when you've been doing it for a couple of decades, and we've done it. More than a couple of decades.
I mean, it's been your life's work. Really.
But you get a sixth sense about what's going to kind of work and what's not going to work and what people are going to respond to. And sometimes, of course, you still miss. And that's where a good editor or a good person you can bounce them off of and they can kind of help you say, that's not quite working.
Who was your bounce?
Well, I've got most... In the early days, I had...
I just asked you who you trusted, didn't I? That's literally who do you trust, right?
Who
do you bounce it off of? Means who do you trust? I mean, it literally means that, right?
Well, the funny thing was is that I would bounce certain cartoons off of some people and other ones off of other people. In other words, if it's going to be on this subject, I'll talk to these folks. If it's going to be this, is it humor? You know, my wife who knows my cartoons inside out, she's seen them 1,000 times. I love to wave things underneath her. But she's a Brit, and so she's a little, you know, she doesn't do...
humor the same way.
No, humor, the British humor is great, but she's not like a boisterous, loud laugh like I would be.
Right.
So if I saw something, I'd go, nah! And so when I see her, she goes, oh, good. I know that's like, wait a minute.
That's
call
a 10.
The headline.
That's a 10. That's great. Cal is here, Kevin Colliger. Finish your thought. I mean, just on that part of it, the humor is where the edge is, and that's where you made fun of the campus president, and that was humor in the wrong way about the wrong person.
All right.
And you even mentioned, and I didn't want to be disruptive because you're so interesting. I got to have you back. Please, let's do this again. We'll stop this because it's interesting. Yeah. Leave them wanting more, like Stairway to Heaven. But you mentioned the face.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that the face, both of you, you confirmed this, Rasig, is the heart and the middle of caricature work and anything that you're trying to draw. Because that's the identification of who. Who, what, where, why, when, right? Boom, 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 boom. All my journalism stuff, right? The Asian part of life, and you've traveled in Asia, and I've traveled in Asia, saving face. So when you talk about wanting to be killed for doing a political cartoon, when you make fun of someone's face, you know, say, keeping my honor, keeping my image, keeping my brand, don't make fun of me. None of us like to be made fun of.
No, nobody.
You know what I mean?
No, right.
Like, he's done a million cartoons of me. All of them sort of make fun of me, but none of them ever hurt my feelings. You know what I mean? There's make fun of me, and then there's kick me really in the balls,
that's
and then
there's
saying something about my mother,
yeah.
And then there's something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
it's
we all have that cultural
when you have
edge,
big figures, they have big egos, too. So I think, you know, when Cal does a caricature of a president or a, you know, I think... You know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Like,
where's
so.
The bridge too far for you at this point? What's something you think that's so effing mean? I do it all the time. I think about. I think a lot of mean things I don't say, right? Or that I could write to myself in some vomit that might make it into a comedy routine. Because if I start doing comedy, that allows me a little different latitude than even what I do on the radio.
Right.
If I take it to a stage, I can work a little more blue.
Right.
I can take little zingers that might not, that would come across over a couple of beers in a bar differently. You know, I mean, for you, where's the bridge too far? Because I'm sure you think over the off the top edge more than you can go off the top
Absolutely.
Edge, right? You have to rein it in always.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I guess there's one a certainty for me is that I will not draw the children of a politician.
Gotcha.
Ah, right.
Because often, you know, you'd have cartoons, you know, particularly when I was doing local cartoons, which I did, you know, when I was doing 5 cartoons a week for The Sun, I usually do 1 a week just on local politics here in Baltimore. You know, they would be easy targets unless a politician dragged them into the spotlight.
Right.
And used them as, you know, as
Now, when you say children of politicians, you don't mean Don Jr.
No, it doesn't. Definitely don't mean Don Jr. I've done Don Jr. But the idea is that they didn't invite themselves
to
be the
special thing. No, they're public figures, though.
Yes, they're public figures.
Those guys are.
Barron Trump is now a public figure.
Isn't that something? Now he is. Funny, I would not have drawn
when
him.
When he was 12.
That's interesting.
A year ago, but now suddenly he's turned into that character.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
But anyways, that's one of mine. And then everything else is that you have to reflect and think. What I tell folks is that, because they say, is there something you can't draw? With the exception of kids. I says, no, I can draw almost everything, but it's how I draw it that becomes the important thing.
Right.
And it's how you describe it.
Right.
When Barack Obama came in, it was a whole bunch of consternation for the first 6 months. But we've got a black man. How are we going to draw this black man without being offensive? And I was looking at it partly because I really take great care in my caricatures. I really like to get more detail in them than many of the people who do very simple versions. And, you know, we quickly got through that. But because, you know, you get into certain areas which are minefields, people can get very nervous, and then they just withdraw and don't try to deal with it. I will like to approach it, but try to do it with smarts and an experience that I've accumulated over nearly 50 years.
Right. I'm going to have you back over Coco's when he's my co-host, because I'm more interested in having you talk to him about cartooning, but I think the next time we get together, we'll actually talk about the politics and talk
Absolutely.
About things and, you know, the Colbert and the thing you have in common.
Yeah.
So to set the record straight on your deal,
yes.
Deposed, yes, knew it was coming, sort of,
yeah.
and had a plan anyway, and yeah. there was an inevitability
yes.
to the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, boy, did I have a great run. I mean, I produced so many great cartoons. But the whole business is in bad shape. The cartooning business is in dire shape. And that'll be something else to talk about in the next time.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do that. Rasig, you got any parting questions for Cal?
I just, you know, it's so fun to be here with Cal.
Do you know each other well or no?
I mean,
we
know each other.
Yeah. At the office.
The
okay.
most The most contact I've had with Cal was at that dinner. But I've always been a huge fan of his.
When I told him you were coming, he was like, oh, my God, look. Yeah.
But I want to say, the reason I love Cal for his cartoons, but I love Cal for Cal.
Cal.
I mean, you've learned it now. He's
never,
one of the great guys in the world.
The first thing he said to me when he had a whole sandwich there and we sat down was, I can't believe I've never met you and you've never met me. And I'm like, I really, because we were in the same newsroom. I was there in 88, 89, fifth floor, Calvert Street. I knew the whole way around. And I got called to Jack Lemmon's office. But, you know, I knew all the Evening Sun guys. John Camejo, Big John, Massey. I knew Philo.
Mike Lane. Did you know Mike Lane?
I did not know Mike Lane.
God, he was also a super talent.
Yeah, I mean, so I just didn't frequent over there, and I knew Rasig well, but Rasig worked off campus. I mean, Rasig worked over on Eastwood Drive, and I go over in his basement, and he'd have sketchboards out. And I always marveled, and I don't talk to you much about cartoons because we wind up talking to our guests or
whatever,
crab cakes, food, coffee. That's how we wound up here. Hey, I know Thomas. Come on down. That's how this whole thing began with you. You should do your show at Zeke. So here I am, Rasig.
Right.
But with you, I would sit in your house when I was young. Even when you were making fun of my Oilers and doing funny things and drawing my kid and whatever, and I would say Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he would have to come up with a sports cartoon, and it'd have to be, and the Colts were gone at that time, you know, and there's no Ravens.
Yes.
And it was just being creative.
Yeah.
Right.
Just being, having an idea, having something that was spark an idea to make a panel that could be funny for a sports crowd that, you know, and he put incredible work. And I mean, his cartoons didn't take 5 minutes, and you would layer them, and he would have the amber and the
amber
cut.
Lift back
in the Oh my God, and the X-Acto knife and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I watched an artisan craftsman. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you had to do the tan suit back in the old days, you would have needed some amber lift.
That's right.
Mike Rossigliano is Rossig. He's the guy in the little hat. Usually Nick the Greek somewhere in the cartoon as well. Follow him out on it. What do you do daily funnies?
I mean, I'm really basically retired, but I mean, I'm on
Facebook.
He's
a whack job on the internet.
I'm on Facebook. I do my trivia on there. There's a lot of cartoons that accompany that. So that's it. That's where I am.
Kevin Colliger's on Substack.
Yeah, man. So it's Caltoons with a K. Caltoons. Like cartoons, .substack.com.
All right.
Yeah. The best. He's the best.
That's it. You got to come.
I don't want to go, but I got to go.
You got to go.
Yeah, that was great.
I feel like a musician at the end. I don't want the show to end.
The treat for me, you know.
All right. Well, we've done all the damage we can do. I'm going to be late. I'm actually going to Coco's for a little crab cake. We're going to be taking a crab cake tour on a little bit of a break for a couple weeks. We are fueled by Zeke's today. My friends at the Maryland Lottery brought us out with Lucky Sevens Doublers, as well as Pressure Lux. There's some folks in here who are going to get some lottery tickets. They don't know it yet, but they're about to. And I'm about to head out, and Luke's about to head to Ravens training camp. All of it brought to you by our friends at Curio Wellness and the Maryland Lottery, as I do 27 of my favorite things to eat 27 days. And the good part is we can all afford them all.
Yeah.
They're all kind of under $20. Is that fair?
No, yeah. I like that.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and there are going to be 27 different businesses. Where I'm sitting here right now in Zeke's Coffee, there are 4 businesses within 2 miles that are places you go in all the time.
Right.
That have my favorite things. And I don't promote them all the time. My favorite cookies are right up there. My favorite peach cake's right over there. My favorite pit beef is right over there. My favorite coconut shrimp is right over there.
Yes.
So I have places I'm
and
going.
Cafe Complete, did you ever get over
no,
there?
No, that's
sorry you didn't. It's gone.
Well, you know why I didn't go? Because I saw him and his wife sitting in there 2 weeks ago, the morning after, instead of the day before. When I come to your neighborhood, I call you.
Oh, I know. I, you know, and we were traveling.
I thought we were friends.
I meant to get you over there before it closed. Yeah.
All right. Rossig is out. Cal will be back, I hope. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and Zeke's Coffee. My thanks to Thomas and everybody here who made it great, including Dan Rogers. Stay with us.